Okay. All right, so the seven Nahid mitzvahs, let's just list them again, just because I started this recording again. On May 4th, Sefer Chanech Mitzvah 452, we start with the seven Nahid mitzvahs, which are don't steal, don't kill, don't blaspheme, don't worship other gods, so no idolatry, don't kill, don't eat the limb of a live animal, don't steal, and courts of justice, establish courts of justice.
Illicit sexual activities.
Oh yeah, and no illicit sexual activities, right. Okay, so this is one of the Sheva Mitzvot Be'Noach. So let's just start hashkafically with a point, which is we don't get this mitzvah from the Sheva Mitzvot Be'Noach. We get this mitzvah from the Torah, because we're Jews. So while this mitzvah does apply to all humanity, our commandment doesn't come from the commandments to Noah or Adam. It comes from, which would be this particular one would be a commandment to Noah and not to Adam. How do you know?
Because Adam came earlier.
He came earlier? Okay, fine. But yeah, but what could Noah do that Adam couldn't do? You know this. You're going to say, oh, as soon as I say it, but eat meat.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah, right. Noah could eat meat, Adam could not.
Right.
He was not allowed to kill animals. After the flood, part of killing an animal, hashkafically, is establishing the difference between us and animals. We're not the same. We don't hold you the same. We can't marry you. We can't have relationships with you. We eat you. We're different than you. So part of allowing us to eat animals was helping to establish that difference. Because apparently there was some confusion before the flood. Some of the illicit sexual behavior that was happening before was with animals. So part of it was to establish difference between humans and animals. We'll see where we're headed right now. It's interesting just to look at our society and where we're going legally, especially because they just brought a habeas corpus lawsuit on behalf of two apes in captivity on Long Island. So habeas corpus, I don't really know that much about this stuff, but as a lawyer, it's
done on their behalf.
It's not just done on their behalf. It means produce the body. Habeas corpus means show the body up. You can't keep somebody in captivity without bringing them out and discussing it out loud with the bodies of law. So that a habeas corpus lawsuit on behalf of animals, of course they can't bring it themselves, but they don't have a corpus like habeas corpuses, meaning they don't have those rights. Basically it's saying these apes have the rights of human beings and you're holding them against their human rights. And so you have to produce their bodies and to discuss their living bodies so that this can be discussed in a court of law. Are you permitted to hold them against their will or not? So even the bringing of such a lawsuit, and I don't know if it ended yet, but or if it was dismissed, but the bringing of it is pushing us toward, like, who would even think you could bring such a lawsuit on behalf of animals? It's one thing to say that animals shouldn't be harmed in experimentation, and they should have certain rights in terms of how you care for them during and after an experiment or during captivity. But it's another thing to say they actually have a right that applies to humans. Mm-hmm. And so we are crossing those lines now. I mean, we are pushing those lines as a society or exploring those lines, certainly legally. Anyway, that's part of the reason why we eat animals. One reason is to say there's a difference between us and them. That being said, we are the custodians of the planet and then the custodians of those who live on the planet, which means that our last mitzvah was shechita. We do have to kill animals kindly as possible. Gently killed, lightly killed, politely killed. That's how we're supposed to do it. Do we always do it that way? We don't. But does our halacha require that? It does. We are forbidden to cause harm to animals. We don't see killing ritually as harm. Meaning you can't cause tsar balechaim, can't hurt them, but we are permitted to kill them.
Which is the whole stun argument.
Right, that you shouldn't, that there's a way to kill them, and stunning, right, stunning does hurt them.
Our argument against.
Right, so should we, does all of the, is it possible to keep the letter of law without the spirit? It is possible, because there are schlachthouses, there are shechita factories where animals are not treated.
Being the word.
Yeah, where animals are not treated. Now, it's hard to have a factory shechita. You can't so easily. Because there's only so fast a human being can hand kill each animal. That's only so fast you can go. However, where you can transgress is by hanging animals.
Them.
No, you can hang animals upside down waiting for shechita. And when there's the cut on one animal and there's a problem and you have to stop the line, other animals are hanging alive, waiting and petrified. And that is Tzar Balei Chaim.
Is that how it's done?
In some places it's done that way. We do have a preference. There's a community preference, not a halachic preference. There's a community preference for what's called shechita munachat, upside down shechita, because the blood drains out faster. So it's not easy to turn a cow upside down. It's not so hard to turn a sheep or a goat upside down, but it's pretty hard to turn a cow upside down. So the way you do it is not nice. So for those people who do shechita munachat or insist on shechita munachat, they're almost insisting, depending on how it's done, but in many cases it is Tzar Balei Chaim. So it's possible to do shechita kosher. That Tzar Balei Chaim inflicted on that animal does not puzzle the shechita. It's still kosher. But the question is, do we want to eat that? If we understand that eating animals does affect us spiritually, and that's why we have only certain animals that we eat, and certain ways that we treat them, then in certain ways that we kill them because it does affect us, then we have to understand there's other aspects of what we eat that affects us. And so here is an aspect of eating that affects us. So that's why I put the word here in Hebrew, achzariut. Achzariut means brazenness or cruelty. We don't want to cultivate a brazenness or cruelty in ourselves. And so therefore, we don't eat Eiver Min HaChai. So Eiver Min HaChai, eating the limb of a living animal. So imagine, and I think this may have been the case, and I don't know enough historically, but I've heard things about it, so it must be possible, that before refrigeration, you couldn't keep a whole animal so easily. So they could cut off. They did learn, apparently,
how to cut off
a limb, and the animal could still live, like they would do surgery on an animal to take off a piece and eat it and leave the rest on the hoof alive. And that was its preservation system. So that is forbidden to all human beings. And, you know, not just that, but I know today recently, I don't know if they're still doing it this very minute, but probably, in Indonesia, they eat monkey brains, but alive. So they stun the monkey, or they. And then they cut off the top of the monkey's head, and they actually have special tables where they put the monkey underneath, special tables with a hole. They put the monkey underneath, and the head is held, and people eat the brains with a spoon right out of the living monkey that's been stunned with his head chopped off. But that's Eiver Min HaChai, that's usher for all human beings. Why is the monkey stuck under the table? It's a horrible thing.
So you don't see it.
Right.
Right.
It's so you don't see it, because how awful is that? It does, but even without seeing it, it does cultivate this brazenness, this cruelty, this achzariut. To eat something before it's even dead, how terrible is that for any human being to be able to have that little compassion that you can eat it, you can put it in your mouth, chew it and swallow it and enjoy it, laugh with your friends and swill it down with a sip of wine, while an animal is not dead in front of you. So that's why it's usher for all human beings, not just for Jews.
Were there a group of people that do this?
In Indonesia. Mm-hmm. Indonesia, where they eat monkeys, yeah. So, but our mitzvah doesn't come from Noach. Our mitzvah comes from the Torah. And so we'll see that for a minute. So
Right,
our mitzvah comes from the Torah. It says you cannot eat the limb of a living animal. Now the question is, how is it then that we eat milk or eggs? Is that Eiver Min HaChai? That's the product of a living animal. You know, so
it's
we
not
have
a limb.
It's not a limb.
It's not a limb, but can you eat a product of? So you also the limb of a living animal, Eiver Min HaChai, also applies to, let's say an animal is injured and its spleen falls out, right? Can you eat that? The animal is not dead. Right? That's not a limb. You can't eat it. That's also under the isur of Eiver Min HaChai, even if it's kosher animal. Even if the animal could live, right? Let's say it lost something, a kidney. One kidney falls out for whatever reason. It got poked, and a kidney pokes out and falls off, and the animal can still live with one kidney, and that animal is a healthy animal that can be shechted, right? Because it's not going to die within a year, for whatever strange reason, right? That's a kosher animal, but that kidney that fell out is not kosher, that is Eiver Min HaChai. So the question is, what about a product of an animal that is its product while it's still alive? Is that mutter or not? So it seems to be a question. So then it has to be dealt with. How do you find where it's mutter? So so the conversation is...
Doesn't it go back to the cruelty?
Is there
cruelty in milk?
Right,
in
is there? Cow? Well, so don't ask a vegan. A vegan would say there is. I mean, that's why they don't, because...
I know.
Yeah, right, but whatever. There's not... It, done properly.
Or eggs.
Not in a factory situation. I don't think there's a cruelty. The way we do it today, maybe there is.
But you have to milk a milking cow.
Yes, you do. Do you have to take a calf away from its mother so that you get to have the milk while the calf is going to turn into veal? Is that very nice?
How about eggs, though? I mean, eggs, that's...
Right,
that's
eggs.
The same thing. That's a live chicken that you.
It's not out. A live chicken. It didn't get fertilized yet.
Right.
So, do we need all those chickens in the world? No, we don't. So, okay. So, is that okay in a farm? In a farmyard is one thing. In a factory where chickens are kept in tiny little cages and they're just egg machines, and you know, and there are some hen houses where they turn the lights on and off, you know, less
18
than
18 hours.
Yeah, at 18 hours, so you get 8 eggs a week instead of 7 eggs a week. Like really turning them into a factory. There's a whole science behind it. So, and that's interesting because you can tell some of the shells. I don't know if you ever got a egg from you have neighbors that have chickens around the corner, the ones who are expecting twins. Do you know who they are? The ones that have the box gardens.
Was that behind Shares?
Not behind Shares. It's like one block.
The ones that have the box.
Yeah. The mm-hmm. Uh-huh. They have chickens.
They're expecting twins.
Mm-hmm. They're expecting twins and they have chickens. So when you get eggs from somebody like that and you give it the regular knock that you do on the counter from the eggs that we buy from the grocery store, it doesn't break them. Like, we know how to give the right hit, right, to damage the shell without making it splat on the counter, right? We've been practiced in that so that we can make our scrambled eggs. You do that with one of those eggs and it just bounces off the counter. Because the shell is so much tougher. Because those are healthier animals that are eating the things they're supposed to be eating. And those shells are, you have to give it a good knock to break. You really do. A really solid knock.
So that just reminds me that Shavuos is coming.
Yes, Shavuos is coming, which we will talk about.
And I make a cheesecake. And one time I had a friend of last year, 2 years ago, I had this friend and we were talking and I'm making it. And I do this on the side of the bowl and the whole thing goes and it's going around.
Oh, all the shell and everything. Aww.
With the cream cheese, with the other eggs, with the, and she also makes, stop the mixer.
Right. Because sometimes you get a thinner one. Sometimes we do feel a thinner one.
Yeah.
Right. So that's a less healthy hen that one came from, with that makes a thinner shell. Yeah, right, exactly. Anyway, so the question is why, so that's just the our deviation away from our subject, talking about are we causing them suffering, but so the concept here is, are you allowed to have this product? So it seems that we do need something special to say that we can. So let's talk about milk first. So those who would say maybe you can't will say, well, obviously you have a pasuk that says, Eretz Zvat Chalav Udvash, the land flowing with milk and honey. How could God praise the land of Israel as a land flowing with milk and honey if milk is not permitted to be eaten? Mm-hmm. Must be that it's permitted. We get it from that pasuk, right? So that's a possibility. Right, so, and there's other things that they wonder, is it kosher or not? But clearly we do understand that it is kosher. It's ruled that it's kosher. However, there's a question about it. Because our kashrus comes from the Torah and not from before. So maybe that's from before the Torah. Maybe even when Avraham is feeding the angels, you know, and it gives them meat and milk, and all the mefarshim go into all kinds of great lengths just to prove that he didn't give it together. He did this way and then not that way. Anyway, our halacha comes from the Torah.
Milk first.
Right. So that's what they say. Right. So one of these, and so you can just write for number two, really, reason why we eat milchiks on Shavuos is, and number one reason, really, is why do we eat milchiks on Shavuos? Because that's when the whole Jewish people converted to Judaism. So all of our meat was treif. We didn't shecht it before then. Again, whatever meat we had wasn't kosher. We're new converts. We have to kosher our kitchens, and we have to shecht new meat according to halacha. And that takes a long time. It's yantif. We have to eat already. So milchiks, that's easy. Quick, you milk the cow, you're done, and you have it. So that's reason number one, right? That's why we have milchiks. Reason number two, Well, I'll give you the halachic reasons, number three. Reason number two is that Torah is compared to mother's milk, right? And that we, and the man is compared to mother's milk, right? But in this case, it's nutritious, it's good for us, it keeps us alive. Yeah, it's compared to water too, but it's compared to, and the man is compared to mother's milk. We got the man, it was falling, and Hashem took such good care of us, and so it's compared, so milk, we have milk just to remind us, right? But number three is, maybe milk is Eivor Min HaChai, or was before we got the Torah. Maybe milk wasn't permitted before we got the Torah. And it only became permitted through an explicit pasuk in the Torah that made it mutter. But if Eivor Min HaChai is usser for all human beings across the planet, maybe it was actually usser before we got the Torah, when it actually permitted it to us. Right? So possibly we eat milchiks on Shavuos to say we accept the Torah, and the Torah permits this food. It's a newly permitted food, and to celebrate, we're going to have a dairy party to celebrate that we got, you know, halachas of, now we can eat dairy. So those are three reasons we eat milchiks on Shavuos.
And they're so good.
Yeah, and so yummy, right?
That's four.
Number four, right. It's a special way to celebrate those who get tired of fleishiks for every yontif. We should. That's such a first world problem, to get tired of fleishiks. You know? You know, there's this hashtag first world problems.
First world problems?
First world problems.
Overdeveloped.
Like, here we are. Like, for us to say fleishiks again, that's like such a first world problem. You know, somebody in the third world, in the developing world, is saying, fleishiks? What's that?
Dinner.
Right.
What's that?
Right. Dinner. What's that? Right? And we're saying fleishiks again. We want milchiks. You know, we want to change it up. We've had so much beef. Let's try lamb. That's such a first world problem for us. Yeah. Okay, eggs. Now the question is eggs. Eggs are different than milk. So eggs, that's also a question. Is it kosher at all? So there's all kinds of halachic discussions. It seems that if it's coming from a living animal, it shouldn't be kosher. Nevertheless, how is it then that the egg fertilized grows into something that is kosher? So that seems to be a problem. Mm. If it does grow into something that, it, once it gets fertilized and then it can grow into a kosher animal, then it seems like what it comes from should be kosher. So there's all kinds of halachic discussion if it's kosher, if it's not kosher. And it seems that there's a real question. It seems that clearly for Jews, eggs are kosher, and there may possibly be a halachic question for non-Jews. So there are some people who say possibly it's lifnei iver, it's putting a stumbling block before the blind, to give an egg to a non-Jew. However, the sages dislike that very much because they don't want to say that something is permitted to a Jew and forbidden for a non-Jew. They rather say the opposite, that Jews have more prohibitions because prohibitions sanctify, and we don't want to say that we actually can do something that they can't do. We just want to say we can't do something they can do. So anyway, it turns out they're allowed to have eggs too. I mean, that's the end of the halachic process, but you know, I'm not into all the halachic minutiae, which is interesting, but if you want, you could listen to Rabbi Rosner and write down all his sources and look them up and learn them with somebody.
He talks about Shavuos, so that's where he discusses it?
He does discuss Shavuos a little bit. No, in this mitzvah, he discusses some of the questions. Why can we eat eggs? Why can we eat milk? And he quotes he cites the halachic sources. You'd have to go and look it up and learn the whole, you know, how and why. But there's a whole halachic process on can you, can't you. So one more interesting thing I learned. To whom does this halacha apply? Right? Eivor Min HaChai. And we talked about shechita. So we talked about shechita. What needs shechita? A behema, a chaya, and an oaf, right? A domesticated animal, a wild animal, and fowl. That's what needs shechita. Fish don't need shechita.
All right.
Does Eivor Min HaChai apply to fish? It seems you do have to kill it first. So we talked about even though fish don't need shechita, they need to be dead before you eat them. There is such a thing as eating live fish. We don't do that. Nevertheless, there seems to be, and here's a weird question, what about animals that were created cabalistically? What if you eat the limb of a living, cabalistically created animal? Are you transgressing this?
We must have too much hand. I'm on our hand.
So apparently there is such a thing. There were some of our sages that did create animals, specifically Lakavit Shabbos Kodesh, and they would eat those on Shabbos. Did they have to be shefted properly or not? All kinds of questions, and it even adds into the question of Yosef and his brothers. Possibly, did he judge them to be eating Aver Minachai? He saw them eating Aver Minachai, and he thought that they were doing an Avera, and in fact, they had created this animal, and so it wasn't an Avera, and he didn't know that. And so that's all kinds of stuff, and why we discuss that kind of stuff with something to learn, but I'm not there yet. Anyway, it turns out that yes, you do need to shecht this kind of animal, not because of this mitzvah, because of maris ayin. Because of, you don't want to lead people astray. Even if you created this kind of an animal, if you're going to eat Aver Minachai from it, you can't do that because other people might not realize that you created it according to Sefer Yetzirah and that it's not an animal that's chayav in this. So we have to shecht all animals so that nobody will be led astray and think that we're not doing it.
I'm kind of stuck on the Kabbalistically created animal.
Right. So we do have that ability somewhere if people understand how to do it. I mean, it's so easy. I mean, think about our phones. Like, how crazy is this instrument? This little flat piece of glass that we fling around. You can FaceTime somebody almost in real time, and sometimes in real time, across the planet. You know, I can just chat with somebody in Australia. And it's connected to nothing, except it's connected to all kinds of things, but it's connected to nothing. How does that work? So is that Kabbalah? It's not Kabbalah. Nevertheless, we have, with our brains, figured out how to make this work. Why is it such a hard leap for us to figure out that there, somehow, there is a way to figure out with our brains how to make that work? I mean, we call this not magic just because, and we don't even understand it. We use this without understanding at all, the three of us, right? How does this work? But we know somebody understands it, so it's not a miracle to us. Like, we know somebody who knows how it works. So, or we know somebody who knows somebody, but we know that it's known, right? That's not a problem for us. Somebody at Google knows how this works. They could explain it to us if we would have the patience to sit and listen. We don't, so we just use it. So, but Kabbalah also works. And somebody knows how it works. We don't. And we might not even know somebody who knows how it works, but we probably know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who knows how it works. It does work. So the question is, how does it work? So, and does it work in every case? It doesn't work in every case, just like this doesn't work in every case. But, and you know, it's interesting when Rabbi Feldheim was talking in Hashir the Shabbos about how the rabbi in that city was able to make the water go down. Great, so you hear that story, but in the same breath, and I would like to see, hear somebody address at the same time, it doesn't always work. Because that same rabbi who could make the water go down so the riverbanks didn't flood, so the town was saved, wasn't able to stop the massacre on the Holocaust. He wasn't. You know, you don't think all his congregants came to him and said, Rebbe, the Germans are coming. Please stop them from coming. He didn't make a wall of an energy field that stopped them. You know, they still came and they still all got killed. So sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. You can make the water go down. You can make a fire stop. We have stories like that that are real stories. And it only works to the extent that God allows it to work in the world. Right? So there's an energy that... Yeah, there's an energy that you can draw upon, and God sometimes allows you
to be.
Right. I mean, so, and that's why we bench somebody. When they go for surgery, what's the frum thing to say? May the doctors be good shlichim, right? May they channel Hashem's energy well, right? Right? They, of course, they have to learn the skill to be able to do that surgery. You can't channel Hashem's energy without having acquired that skill. So you need to acquire that skill. But then you're hoping that that doctor is able to open himself up to the healing energy that Hashem is sending to that patient and that they're able to bring it to that patient. But it's Hashem's energy. It's not their energy. They're not the miracle workers. They're just doing what Hashem wants done in the world, which is why sometimes the best doctors can't save a person. And sometimes not such a great doctor can. You know, so it's not about the doctor's skill. It's about what Hashem wants.
So this is the most bizarre thing. I was in Paris last week, and I had lunch with a friend of mine who's in the Jewish community there, and I wanted to ask him all the normal questions about
what's going on in Paris, let's hear.
How many friends, and all of that. And then, you know, we were talking a little bit about business, and then that, and then, unfortunately, good lesson to me, I said, and how's your family, Pierre? Wrong time to ask it, because he said, not well. Mm-hmm. And he tells me this story, and of course I start, it's unbelievable. He said, my 14-year-old son died last year. And I'm like, oh, he says, no, it's okay. And I'm going, how
is it okay?
How is it okay? And he said, well, if you're a believer, I'm going to tell you this story. And he said, he and his wife, the mother of this child, had split up a long time ago, and they're very kind, very nice. They both got remarried. Everybody gets along. This kid's 14th birthday, they all say, what do you want for your birthday? And he said, all I want is for all of us to have dinner. It wasn't acrimonious, that wasn't that unusual, but the four of them never got together. Mostly he lived in Paris, mostly they lived in the South, but it wasn't that, you know, and he kept saying, what else? He said, no, just us have dinner. Okay, five of us, fine. No, you know, nothing. At the week after, he has a 10-minute asthma attack, and that's it. But, so then Pierre says, I want to show you this picture. And he pulls out his phone, and here's a picture of this gorgeous, you know, post-bar mitzvah, gorgeous kid with wings, angel wings. And he said, he photoshopped this picture of himself and posted it to his Facebook a week before he died.
Wow.
And I'm, you know, I'm
right.
crying. And this, he's perfectly peaceful. And then he said, and then he did this, and he pulls up his texts, and every text has the phone number, you know how they are, they have a name or a phone number, and there's one that only has 3-digit phone number, and he translates it, and it says, I'm up here, Dad, and I'm okay. And it was like 3 months after the kid died.
What? Wow.
And, you know, he said, I mean, now, you know, he said, it was just, he said the whole thing was some plan.
Right.
And
right.
The whole
thing
was what?
A plan.
Some plan.
That Hashem helps. Says, yeah.
I mean,
Hashem does help plan
I'm
that
crying,
kind of thing.
And
yeah.
He's totally at peace
he,
with this.
Yeah.
I mean, he really believes. Or maybe he has to. You don't know.
He's worked on it.
He's
yeah.
He's worked
right.
on it. And you
right.
know, I don't.
I mean, I also the what's their names in Florida? They lost
Ansel,
their.
Ansel.
No, no, the Amsels?
Amsel.
No, another family in Florida, their 12-year-old was crossing a very busy intersection. She was struck and killed. Complete shock, you know, like that. And she was paying attention to the light. Some other driver wasn't. But in the month leading up to that, she had finished a birthday present for her sister a little bit early and gave it to her early. Mm-hmm. She, like, couldn't stand, like, she didn't want to wait till her birthday. And she had given away a few of her trinkets. Like, she was preparing for death. Like, she had tied up some loose ends in her 12-year-old life. Which, you know, nobody saw in advance, but in
right.
hindsight, I was like, why did she do that?
Yeah.
What 12-year-old finishes a birthday present a month in advance and then has to give it that day? Like, you know, what 12-year-old, whatever, this, that, and the other thing? And so there are things like that.
I guess we believe
that.
In
there
premoni-
is,
I don't know if it's
yeah,
premonition.
Premonition. It's not quite a premonition, because it's not like she's thought, I'm going to die,
so
I
right,
better.
Or
it's just that Hashem does arrange for certain things. Like, why did he want that dinner? He didn't know he was going to die.
Right.
But to get that kind of
and
closure for him.
And it wasn't that it had been an uncomfortable relationship
right.
between his parents.
Right, yeah.
They'd been divorced a long time. They'd both been remarried a long time. They were, he has, Pierre has a house in the south of France also.
So right, so Hashem does run the world, it turns out.
Yeah.
And people who understand parts of it can participate in it. That's what I'm saying. It's not that any Jew can do Kabbalistic things that are against what Hashem wants. But he does provide that energy, and if we learn how to use it, a Jew can participate in that. That's what I'm saying. So,
you know, can you create an animal?
Yeah, right.
You know, I guess.
I mean, think about it. In the times, in Greco-Roman times, were there people that were intelligent enough to run a computer, to conduct a symphony? There were.
Sure.
There weren't those instruments at that time. Could human beings have created those instruments at that time? They could if they hadn't yet. Did that like knowledge exist, attainable by human beings? It did. We just hadn't reached it yet. It's not that it had to be built one after another, like certainly musical instruments. All those instruments in the symphony could have been made with the same tools they had in Greco-Roman times, right? Because they didn't have much else
mm-hmm.
at that time. So it's just, they hadn't thought of it yet. So, and the same thing in the 1950s till today, could we have had smartphones in the 50s? Maybe. I mean, like, I don't know all the scientific stuff, but really, we could have just, The knowledge is there. We just have to touch it.
Well, knowledge does have to be built. I mean, it's like what I keep saying. Let's hurry up and finish this so we can start
right,
it again.
Right. You know? I know. There is so much, right?
Because I feel like we've really grown.
I've grown through it, yeah, for sure,
you know,
so far.
Now I know enough to study this.
Right, to really start looking at it. Right.
Enough to study. Anyway.
Okay, perfect. Okay. Segue into 453.
Okay.
Okay. So 453, to attend to bringing an animal offering from another land to the sanctuary in Israel, right? Let's see, where did we go back?
Yeah,
so let's see what the Sefer HaKanach says, right, okay. Right, to bring to the chosen temple and to offer up there what we have become obligated to bring, as a chatat, an asham, or an ola, or a shlamim. Even if those animals are outside the land of Israel, duty lies on us to bring them up to the chosen place. Okay, so now we live in Mexico.
Mm.
Or Babylonia. Let's just make that easier. We live in Babylonia, right? We did, and the Beit HaMikdash is in existence. So we did whatever Aveira or whatever good thing, right? And now we have to bring a carbon. Oh, okay, you got to designate that animal, and you actually have to schlep. That's what this is saying. Of course you have to bring it, but this is an additional mitzvah saying you live far away, make the effort. It's not actually optional. So really the big idea of this mitzvah is you have to put forth a lot of effort to keep the Torah. Just because it's hard, it doesn't mean you don't have to do it, which is one of the sentences I used to tell my kids, which they hated. So nevertheless, that's what this mitzvah is, amelus. The word is amelut, amelus, working hard to keep the Torah, that is part of the effort. And if you think about it, with what we understand now, having learned Derech Hashem together also, we understand that really it's all about us being in the process. It really isn't about results. So it isn't about, of course you have to bring it, but it's not about how much you accomplish in this world. It's about how much effort you put it. The accomplishment is the effort. So here it's saying it's a lot of effort. Yeah, you have to do that effort. It's not about having an extra meeting and you're going to miss that meeting for your fundraising event if you do this. Yeah, you're going to miss it. You're going to miss that business deal. Yeah, you're going to miss it. You're going to miss 3 weeks of work because you have to walk all the way from Bavel to the Beit HaMikdash to offer your thing and to walk back. Yeah, but every single one of those steps is this mitzvah. It's such an important thing to know. We have to work hard in order to acquire Torah in our lives. In order to become transformed through Torah, it takes a lot of work. So we can't just think, yeah, it's too hard for me. You know, it's different teaching this, even the small group, than some other, let's just say, other people, because, you know, it's hard to say straight up that, yeah, you have to work really hard. And no, it's not always easy, you know, and not everybody wants to hear that, but yeah, it's hard. And it's true, we can say, I'm not up to that. That is a thing that somebody could say. And we have to make sure that we're really not. We have to push ourselves to be up to that. You know, whatever it is, to really work hard and
I always
give ourselves a push.
Of the Chabad rabbis the one that comes to mind is in Cuba, and there was no mikvah in Cuba, so every month she flew to Venezuela.
Wow. Right.
To go to the mikvah.
There you go.
She couldn't go to the ocean, or she wasn't on the ocean.
I don't know what.
Yeah, or maybe she did go to the ocean.
She did some shopping too.
Yeah, there are people.
Maybe
who
she
go.
Did shopping yeah. too. Yeah. Probably.
Ocean, I don't know.
Ocean, yeah.
Or somewhere.
Yeah, yeah, there are people who use the ocean, yeah.
But
but there are people, right.
To get to.
Right. Well, there are people who are like, also the rabbis and rabbisons that I visit in Madison, so it's not as far, but they have to go to Milwaukee for the mikvah. So it's not the easiest thing to have to drive an hour and a half each direction.
Find someone to leave your kids with.
Right, and then to drive, and it's far, and it's,
Boulder,
it's a schlep. Right. Right, yeah, the Boulder, right. So it's,
they still? Like,
no, there's a mikvah now in Boulder, yeah. Yeah, but
now,
think
now
of it, yeah.
The East Siders have to go to the West or the
right,
South.
Right, right, right. Or Southeast. Right, Southeast. But, I mean, so we do have to work hard on it. And imagine I was just thinking about the Chabad rabbi in Kathmandu, or Nepal, wherever he is. I think he's in Kathmandu, right?
I think Kathmandu is the biggest center in the world.
Right, so here you have it. So it's amazing to know that, you know, here he is, outposted, just waiting, receiving Israelis. That's his job. Your post-army, you're going to stop by that Chabad. He knows who he's getting, what his clientele is. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, he's inundated with all these earthquake victims, and everybody knows Chabad's the place to go. You know, it's amazing. It's amazing. And that they just go, and they're there. And that is a Melas Torah. That is saying, wherever there's a Jew, I'm going there. And that's something beautiful that Chabad has done. You know, wherever there's a Jew, we're sending somebody. Somebody's going to set up shop because that's what we do. It's hard on our family. Our kids don't get the education we need. I don't have friends. It's hard is not a reason to not do it. You know, that's what we do. So that's what this mitzvah is about. It's hard. Do it anyway, because that's the mitzvah. So
it'd be one of the most important mitzvahs.
Yeah. And it's, right. It's interesting. Now, we might, I'll read what it says inside. We might possibly say that a particular precept was given to us about holy offerings from outside the land to adjure us about them, because the trouble they involve is much greater than the burden with the holy offerings in the land, which are nearer to the temple. However, Rabbi Moses ben Nachmanides, Ramban of blessed memory, wrote that all holy offerings, both those in the land and those from abroad, are all under one precept, and we are not to make two precepts of them. Here it's made into two, right? And although it is true that in the Midrash Sifrei is interpreted to refer to holy offerings from outside the land, in truth, there's no proof that they're to be taken as two precepts. In the Talmud tractate Truma, sages of blessed memory interpreted to the verse in a different regard, for they said, only are holy things. So it's the question is, can you exchange them for money, send them money, you know, all those kinds of things? And it's basically not. You have to bring them.
Could you have someone else bring your offering?
It's a good question. I think you're supposed to do it.
You have to do it in order to get the benefit otherwise.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think in a way, and I don't know, I'm just now just thinking about this, but let's think about the impact of that. If you're a Jew who takes Torah seriously during the times of the Beit HaMikdash, are you going to move to Mexico? You know, because you're going to say, you know, that's really too far. To get from Mexico back to the Beit HaMikdash, if I have to bring a carbon, I can't live that far from the Beit HaMikdash. It's just too far. I'm not moving that far away, right? I'll be a week's travel, but I'm not going to be a half a year's travel because that's too much. So in a
Unless
way...
Unless you're a Chabad family and you say, my job.
Yeah. So I'm saying during the times of the Beit HaMikdash. Right. So unless you're
or
unless
the
you
people,
have a reason,
whoever those people at that time were that reached out to
right,
Jews
who
in other
out.
Places.
But what I want to make the comparison to is to the conservative ruling that you could drive a car on Shabbos, right? Because what did that do? Even if you want to say they now have admitted that was a mistake, but at the time that they made that ruling, they thought of it as a halachic ruling that you could drive a car to the synagogue on Shabbos. And why? Because it keeps people coming. What it really did, though, was kill communities. Because once you can drive, you don't have to live in walking distance. If you have to live in walking distance of your synagogue, that means you have to live in walking distance of your community, which means you live in a community. So once you can drive, you destroy the Jewish community. And they did. It did. They don't live together. So as annoying as it might be to live in a community where there's judgment, where there's, you know, whatever it is, but you live in a community where there's community, where people take care of you, where people notice you didn't come to shul, you're an older person, let me stop by and visit you. Let me see how you're going. Let me bring you some meals after you had a baby. Let me look. Who even knows people who live in the middle of the suburbs who drive to shul who don't have a Jewish neighbor for blocks, right? Who's bringing them meals after they give birth? They're not, because they're stopping by whatever, you know, non-kosher store to get, but it's like that's not a way to live as a Jew. You know, we are community animals. That's who we are, community beings. It's interesting because I want to learn more about the biology, but one of the things, or it's not biology, it's botany. Tzadik katamar yifrach. The righteous will flourish like the palm tree. So there's lots of different reasons, but one aspect of that I learned is that palm trees only give their fruit when they grow with other trees. They have to grow in community because they have to cross-pollinate. A palm tree by itself won't grow fruit. So a tzaddik katamar yifrach, part of the aspect of a tzaddik blossoming like a palm tree is they have to live in a community. Tzaddikim have to be in community or they won't bear their fruit.
Well, learning is almost always done.
It has to be done. That's right. It has to be done in community. That's right.
You know, you have to have a chavruta.
Right. So I would imagine that this mitzvah might help enforce a little more close in community for those people who care, because how far away are you going to go already if you know you have to go close? Okay, that being said, let's move on to just beginning this big mitzvah, which will be the subject of right now and the next class. the prohibition against adding the precepts to adding to the precepts of the Torah. So mitzvah 454, which is really a pair with 455, which is the prohibition against taking away precepts from the Torah. Well, let's start by looking inside, and then we have a Rambam to look at. Okay, so 454, that we were restricted not to add anything to the written or oral Torah. About this, it was stated, you shall not add to it. Now, how might this addition be made? What is it talking about when it says add to it? Rambam says, and we're going to see inside. For instance, if a scholar rules that the flesh of fowl in milk is forbidden by the law of the Torah, he thus adds something in the oral tradition. For so we receive the tradition distinctly, you shall not boil a goat, etc. So it was made forbidden to boil meat from a domestic animal or a wild animal in milk, but not the meat of a fowl. So too, if one ruled that animal meat is permitted in milk. Okay, so this whole long thing. Okay, so what does that mean? What does it mean? So we have lots of additions, right? All kinds commentary. Of things. Forget commentary. This is an addition to observance, right? So this is the perfect example. Is chicken allowed? Are you allowed to have chicken parmesan, right? The answer is no. Why? Not because it's forbidden from the Torah. It is not forbidden from the Torah. It is forbidden from our sages. How were they permitted to add that in as halacha? Right? Because this mitzvah says, no, you cannot add that in as halacha. So the answer to that particular aspect is, you can't add it in as scriptural halacha. If our sages would say, when the Torah says, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk, it's also referring to fowl, and that's why you can't have chicken parmesan, that would be transgressing this. They are allowed to make what's called a siyag l'Torah, a fence for the Torah. Right? So if they'll say, it's kind of confusing that all the animals, you for sure, this verse, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk, you might translate that too narrowly and say it's only referring to goats, not to sheep, not to cows. You might even translate it more narrowly and saying it only refers to that animal in its mother's milk, but somebody else's mother is fine, right? So that would be taking away from the Torah. We understand that this does refer to all domesticated animals and all chayas even. So deer too, no deer in milk, even if it's cow's milk. It doesn't have to be the same species of milk. No deer in milk. So now that we have two categories of animals that require shechting, that require shechita, that can't be boiled in milk, that can't be eaten with milk, so it's a little confusing to say this third category that requires shechita, fowl, can be eaten with milk. It could get confusing, so our sages said it's not forbidden from the Torah, but we're going to forbid it just to make kind of one rule, blanket the entire thing, to make it just easier for everybody to keep it carefully. More black and white, because we are worried that if this permitted is permitted and that's not permitted, that it's going to make for a lot of confusion. And so in order to protect that, we're making a rabbinic ruling. We're not calling it biblical. It's a rabbinic ruling.
So fish isn't shechted, and that's the differentiator?
It's not shechted, right. Yeah, in this case, I think...
That makes it parv?
Yeah, it's parv.
That's why it's parv? Because it's not shechted?
No, it's parv, right. Chicken, technically, according to the Torah, would be parv also.
Except it's shechted.
It's still parv. If you could have it with milk, it's parv.
Because it doesn't say goat and fowl. It does. It says meat.
Because it doesn't say. That's the point. So that pasuk... Because we have oral and written law together, we have the written verse, do not cook a kid in its mother's milk, and we have the oral understanding that is biblical. That oral understanding, even though it's rabbis that said the words, they received it at the same time as the Torah, so it is considered deraisa. It's not derabanan. It's deraisa, how we understand this pasuk. This pasuk refers to all animals, not birds. All kosher animals cannot be eaten with milk.
Right.
Period. Right? So it's all animals. That verse that says, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk, means all animals, all deer, all sheep, all goats, all cows, all of them, all buffalo. None of that can be eaten with milk. But it does not refer to all fowl.
Right. So the rabbis went and
fowl biblically would be parv, even though they require shechita. Right? So it's a strange category. It then fowl is now in between fish and meat. Requires shechita, but it's parv. Right? So, And it tastes meaty. Like, it doesn't taste, it is different than beef, but maybe it's just our acculturation that we think of it as so fleshic. But we do think of it as fleshic. It's got the umami, it's got, has a different umami.
Well, I'm trying to figure out why fish, why is they it? Didn't make a similar rule about fish.
Right. It's interesting that many Sephardim don't eat fish with milk. They will eat, they won't have lots of bagels and cream cheese. It's not a Sephardish zach, it's an Ashkenazic thing. Because they are careful to not mix milk and fish. Fish doesn't make you fleshic, it is parah, but they won't have it with milchiks. So there is that somewhere in the Jewish world. It's not in our world, because we Ashkenazim in this room do have cream cheese and lox together in a bagel. It's not a problem for us, but I have a friend who's married to a Persian, and he won't have it. She will. She's Ashkenazic. So in the one house they have, you know, different things, but
so I still don't understand why fish was designated as
it's a flaky meat. It's very different looking.
It's a different, yeah.
It's very, very different looking, yeah.
To me it is a different,
yeah.
I can see why chicken would be considered fleshic.
Right. And possibly fish. Right. And possibly that's why when the Gemara says it's a sakana to have fish with meat, what is it talking about? Because we don't have fish with meat.
No,
that's why we're careful with separate plates and separate forks and all that stuff. And we do this whole big, you know, thing. We serve the fish first. And then we take it off the table. And we clear all that stuff. Right. Right. What is that about? And it's because the Gemara says it's a sakana. It's a danger to have meat and fish together. What's the danger? So some people say it's a Kabbalistic danger and we don't. And that's why we have to be careful with our Worcestershire sauce and what Worcestershire sauce we use on... You know, on our meat, yeah, because if it's fishy, is it a problem? So it could be that the danger is referring to the fact that you might mix up meat and fish, and that we want to keep those categories separate.
You like might think it's
right in order to
instead of
yeah,
fish-like.
In order to keep fish really separate in our minds from meat, so that we don't come to transgress on meat and milk or fish and milk or whatever it is, like where those lines are. This keeps the line of fish very separate from the line of meat. That it might not be a physical sakana, but it might be a spiritual sakana.
Mixing different species?
Well, you can mix species.
Well, you can do that, because you can put lamb and beef.
Yeah, you can cook lamb and beef and goat all together. Yeah, that's not a problem. Right, it's not about the species, but it's a different category. Maybe it's mixing the different halachic categories, because if you're taking the fish and saying that's parv. So you could take a zucchini, which is parv, and mix it with meat. Why can't you take a fish, which is parv, and mix it with meat?
What? Oh, you can't take a. You can't make a stew with fish and chicken.
Right. You can't even fish and chicken.
I can't think of one.
Right. No, you can't. You can't. Well, there's Cajun recipes that have that kind of thing. Yeah.
Sausage.
Sausage and shrimp. Yeah. They have that. Yeah. So, so we don't mix the. We don't mix that, and it could be that's one
paella.
Reason why. Yeah. Right. In a paella, we would have to make that separate. So. So you can't add on to it. So the question is, how do you not add? There's all kinds of adding. So we'll go into that much more at length. But let's just say I'll just give you the first example of where it was added, where the Torah was added to, and then we'll look at the Rambam next time, is Chava. The very first Avera in the world, before the Avera of eating from that forbidden fruit, was Chava actually adding to the Torah that she got.
Uh-huh.
Right,
the
Torah
knowledge
was
knowledge of good and knowledge, or knowledge of good and evil.
It was the tree of knowledge of good and evil. That's what it was.
Right,
the tree of knowledge of good and evil. What was her Torah?
What Adam told her.
But what was it?
He said it was just the tree, just the tree of knowledge.
Tree of knowledge of good and evil, right?
Eat it, or she would die. He said she would die.
She added the touching.
That's right.
Oh, she added.
Right. So if you want to, okay, going back to just very quickly, this our hashkafic point, which is so important to remember. What is Torah? Torah is how we use this physical world to grow our spiritual selves. We Jews today have 613 mitzvahs of how to grow this way and not diminish ourselves that way. You need both. Do this, skip that. The Torah requires that, right? So we have our package that teaches us how to do that at our spiritual stage right now. Adam and Chava had a Torah, right? Their Torah was a do and a don't. From all the trees of the garden, eat. Don't eat from that one. That was their Torah. That was it. Don't eat from that one. You eat from that one, you die, right? Okay. That's the Torah. She knows the Torah. Now she's standing by the tree, and the snake says, doesn't this look delicious? And she says, Hashem said, we're not allowed to eat it. And we're not allowed to even touch it. That's this Avera. Adding on to the Torah. Because Hashem didn't say that. She could have said, and as a special precaution for myself, I have chosen not to even touch it.
Not to even climb up and sit.
Right.
There.
I'm not even going to touch it because I want to be super careful. But she didn't say that. What she said was, Hashem said, don't eat it and don't even touch it. So when the snake then got her to touch it, then she realized, I'm not dying, so then it's okay to eat it, right? So it's very confusing. So that's this Avera. Don't add on. You could add a fence. She could have said, I have chosen, therefore, not to touch it because I'm so nervous about coming to eat it by mistake because it does look delicious. All right, so I'm not going to get involved with this tree at all. That is mutter, and we're permitted to do that, but not what she did. So we'll explore this further. What does it mean to add? What does it mean to take away? And why and how do we do that in our halachic process these days? Okay. We should all add to our simcha in keeping Torah. Holy.